In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Betches Media presents.
Madam Speaker. Madam Vice President.
You want to hang out with us? You get your vaccine.
And so I went to Human Resources.
There's some things I just can't tell you on air.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
A woman's problem, if you will.
Hello, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Elise Morales.
And I'm Millie Tamaras.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast, where C-SPAN meets group chat to help you process and laugh at the biggest topics in U.S. news and politics. Hi, welcome back to the USA, Millie.
Yes, you know, America's a lie is what I was That's like part of my stand-up now. But like, you know, happy to be back. I was definitely ready to come back. But also, man, we were taught so many lies.
Wait, and you just, what about this 10-day or however long trip really made you zone in on the lies we've been told?
Well, you know, just like that, I just like how cheap it is there. And, you know, we've been peddled all these things of like, oh, America is like the best place in the world and we have everything going and like everywhere else is a third world country and kind of sucks. And then like, I just keep remembering like, in 90 Day Fiance, Paola, she's from Bogota and this guy lives in rural Oklahoma. And like, I was in, Bogota's like the biggest city in Colombia. I was not in the biggest cities. I was in like small cities and they were fucking awesome. So I'm just like, I just remember his family being like, oh my God, like, how dare you? Like, or like, she's just using you for your green card. And I'm like, you can get 10 pre-rolled joints of weed for $6 in Colombia and ass implants for $50. Like, why the fuck would she want to move to rural Oklahoma if not for love? And then I guess the final nail in the coffin was that any McDonald's in the U.S., all the fucking ice cream machines suck, are broken. And in Colombia, and I found out through some beautiful DMs that all over South America, there's ice cream only McDonald's locations where you can get a McFlurry, cones, everything. But in America, no ice cream machines work.
They don't work. All I ever want is a McDonald's ice cream cone. They're so good.
They're like good. They're consistent. You know, with this caramel. No, bitch.
I also grew up knowing that they were like, they're like one Weight Watcher point.
Oh,
which
Jesus.
Is really sad.
No,
but they're actually a very, they're a healthy sweet snack, but it makes it even more disappointing when they're closed, because you know who's always works tragically is Chick-fil-A, and they have a similar style of ice cream cone.
Sadly.
I was so nervous about your motorcycle tour.
I was too. That was, I think like sometimes I'm too brave and like I do things, I sign up for them and I'm like, this is going to be awesome. And then right before I'm about to do, I'm like, I think like all the like paranoia and like, wait, Millie, is this a good idea? That sets in like 5 minutes before. So I thought I could ride motorcycles because I ride Revels, which are like scooters, like mopeds throughout the city. But those are automatic and the motorcycles are not. They were manual. So I was stalling out in like some like.
Not where you want to stall out.
I was stalling out where I didn't want to stall out. I'll also say this too. I do ride Revels all over the city. I've ridden it across. Fucking roads are nicer in Colombia. Like the highways, no potholes, nothing. Now, if you go off the highway, there's dirt roads, lots of rocks, inclines. It's super dangerous. But on the actual highways, and I was just thinking about infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, they took advantage of COVID. Like, and they repaved all these roads. And I was like, dude, fuck the U.S.
I thought this whole trip was just a really like a reflection on American exceptionalism. You're just like, oh, the McDonald's ice cream, the infrastructure. I just didn't see every, just doing a documentary, a 10-part documentary.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, finally, I think I want to be a better motorcycle rider, because they were taking me through some beautiful waterfalls and jungles and hills. And it was so gorgeous, but I was just so worried about not dying and so stressed out about it that I couldn't enjoy I couldn't take it in, because my asshole was like 2 centimeters, like so tight. And I was so fucking scared.
Well, now you have a goal.
Yeah, no, I have a goal. Yeah, for sure. It's good to have goals. It's good to have goals.
It's good to be suspicious of America. Totally. It's good to be suspicious
of America. A lot of expats there, and they're all like hanging out and living that life too. So that was also interesting. I would read
the Millie Motorcycle Diaries, where Millie travels across Latin America, inspiring the masses to movement. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell them, just stay here. I just want you to know, like, don't go, don't leave. Like,
when we get to the migrants at the border situation, really what we need to do is send Millie down there on a motorcycle and say, go back.
Yeah, this shit sucks. But yeah, if my mom was like, aren't you worried about it being scary? And I'm like, listen, if my kidnapper is hot enough, I'm not coming back.
So today we will obviously address that migrant situation in our last segment. First, we're going to touch on the Emmys, which we didn't touch on yesterday. And we're going to talk about some new challenges to the Texas abortion law. I suspect these are not the challenges that the Right to Life people hoped for. So that will be exciting to get into. So to start with the Emmys, the Pared Down Award show handed out statue after statue to actors from Ted Lasso and The Crown. In a year with a record number of nominations for people of color, 44% actually, they weren't actually rewarded with the prizes, especially acting ones, which prompted Emmy So White trend on Twitter. I mean, I couldn't believe this, that Anthony Anderson was up for his 11th Emmy. I guess
Kenan Thompson. Oh my God. When will they give this man? They nominated him twice for being in Kenan and for SNL. And it's just,
it's rough.
Just the one where I'm like, just give this man an Emmy or leave him alone.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, the host was like, I mean, sorry, this isn't your year because of Ted Lasso. But it's like, they say that
every year.
Well, this is what we're going to talk about. But a few other lowlights that could have been highlights were that MJ Rodriguez, she was nominated for Pose, and she was widely expected to make history as the first ever transgender performer to win a trophy for leading female actor. She did not. Olivia Colman won her bajillionth award. Olivia Colman, but I don't think she needs any more awards. The Academy also had an opportunity to award the Outstanding Guest Actor Prize to Michael K. Williams for Lovecraft Country, but did not. He tragically passed away a few weeks ago, and this was sort of evocative of the Oscar ceremony, where they did not award Chadwick Boseman, who had also recently passed away. A Black Lady sketch show took home only one award, even though it was nominated in 5 categories. So this year, as we said, it's a record nominations throughout the awards, with better representation than in previous years. Why is there still this gap? I mean, between all of the nominations, and then yet you watch the show and it's The Crown, Ted Lasso, The Crown, Ted Lasso, The Crown, Ted Lasso, and just overlooked every single category. What is this disconnect between nominations and wins?
Well, I mean, the majority of Emmy voters are white. So obviously, like, they want to see their experiences reflected back to them. So it's an issue with who's voting. And also, I think it's an issue of what, at the end of the day, to them is considered prestige TV. And like, what is actually, like, The Queen's Gambit won a ton of awards, right? And it's like, that's like the perfect, I think, like, prestige TV show. Totally. Mare did really, really well. A lot of these quote unquote prestige shows focus on white people, whereas, like, you know, Lovecraft Country is like a science fiction show that's on one of, you know, that's like coming out of a streaming service and all these different things. So I think, like, because people of color's stories often get told via like different avenues than what is considered like the most prestigious of the TV, like the ways to be on TV, is probably a lot of it. I think I don't know if you guys like watched the entire Emmys, but I watched them. And there was this one part that I think was so indicative of the issue with this Emmys, which is, this guy from The Queen's Gambit won a writing award. He went up there. He talked through the music twice. He refused, like literally he had a 2-page essay and he was like, I am reading this. He had absolutely nothing of interest to say. Very boring, generic speech. I don't think that he's the one who told Anya Taylor-Joy she was bringing sexy back, but I think it was a different member of the team's Queen's Gambit team.
Send bringing sexy back to chess.
To chess, yes.
Oh, because that's what it's been missing. That's what it's been missing. I thought I must have turned it off. As I said on the podcast, I go to sleep at 9:30, so that must.
I've heard that that was a joke on their set, and it's like, okay, I also hate that that was a joke on your set. Are we still referencing sexy back? It's 2021. Let's do other things.
Well, but, yeah, that's the last pop song these assholes listen to.
But right after him, Michaela Cole went up for winning. She won a writing award for I May Destroy You. She didn't win for her performance, which is also ridiculous. But so she won a writing award and she gives this gorgeous, succinct, incredible speech that like is really poignant. Probably, I would say, the most poignant moment of the night.
Yeah.
And it just felt so indicative of the whole thing to have this sort of like pompous white dude who no one wants to hear from giving like a bloated speech that inspires no one and refusing to get off the stage. And then Michaela Cole, who actually is someone who maybe the audience would want to hear a 2-page fucking speech from, comes up there, knocks it out of the park in like 30 seconds and gets off the stage and makes the biggest impression of the night. And it's just like, that's what we're dealing with in entertainment, is there are still so many like old fuddy white dudes who think they want to, who think you want to hear them talk about chess.
All right. And I think it's a few issues too, like with everything that Elise said. It's like, to go back to these like guys, it's like, they are used to a media that focused on them, where they're the primary target, where everything that they liked and they enjoyed and was aimed to them is the cool, edgy thing and nothing else matters. And there is a little baby tiny shift of like a small, small percentage of media that now is focusing on other people or even aimed to target other people. And again, just a tiny percentage. And these guys are like, they don't know what to do with themselves. They did not think that that would happen in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And they did not think that they'd have to deal with that. So like, it is this shift that's happening. So the thing about like these other stories is, it's like, yeah, now we're seeing like a small percentage, like a small market share, a small percentage of budgets at these streaming services are going to, you know, other stories, but it's still like not comparable. Like, I think too, it's all about budget. It's like budget to pay the actors, budget to, you know, set design, all that stuff. It's just not comparable when you talk about, you know, The Crown. I think like a big part of, or a big case study, which you could, there was an article about it, I think in the LA Times, about the Selena series, the on Netflix, the Selena whatever. And like what they've been asked. So it's cool, right? Like, yay, Latinx story, Selena. Well, their writer's room was asked to do like 20 weeks for just something where it's like they were given half the amount of time to make double the amount of content. Mm-hmm. It's a period piece. It's 1995. So that is really, expensive. And they're totally given no budget. And then it looks really cheap. You know what I mean? Because they have no wardrobe. They don't have access to the cars. When you think about that compared to the fucking Crown, totally, where like they had endless amount of budget. And it's not even just the budget to create, but it's also the budget of promoting the 4-year consideration campaigns. It's kind of like cyclical, where it's like, yeah, like these white stories, these, it speaks to the execs more, so they're gonna put more money into the show. And because they're putting in like higher actors, like higher white actors that are paid more, and then because they put all this money to fucking make it, they're gonna put all this money to promote it, where like, you know, these other shows aren't getting that same budget. So there's like that aspect of like from the development process in general. And then I'm just thinking about these fucking nominations, where it's just like every year we have this issue, and it's just, it kind of drives me crazy, because I'm seeing the trickle down effects of this as like a comedian who's starting a career, I'm sure at least has, where it's like, you know, it's like, fuck, dude, give these people a bone. Like, there are so many, like Z-Way, for example, mm-hmm. her show, they did it for, they, it didn't even get nominated. The only two things that were
that
nominated.
That was a big snub, I felt, that they exactly. had to nominate Z-Way.
Exactly. And it was like SNL and Black Lady Sketch Show. And like, which one do you think, the show that's been going on for 40 years, that Jim Carrey and fucking Norm Macdonald, like all these like classics have been mm-hmm. on, and it's been on for 40 years and it's on every week, or the like Black women thing that's only been on 2 years and like the last season was a year ago or something. The thing is too, I'm just like, just give these fucking people a bone. Mm-hmm. Just like, why do we need so many, you know, it's like, why are we oversaturating it? Like, what is the message? And then it makes it difficult for the people in those projects, in these people of color projects, to leverage more pay or this and that and like their next projects. And then it also makes it difficult. I think when I'm saying I see the trickle down effects, it's like, studios execs like don't want to take a chance on people of color. They want you to be so fucking like well-oiled, you know what I mean? Like out there that like by the time you're developing things, that's when they want to consider you for a staff role or you know what I mean? And like,
well, it's like the people on Angry or on a Black Lady Sketch Show. They are all extremely seasoned mm-hmm. people. Like this is a career step for them that had they been white men, they would have probably gotten like 10, 15 years ago. They have already all done
exactly
so much in the industry. And like you yeah. said, like when you, and then when you only reward the crown, it's like the cycle continues because people only want to hire people that are a sure bet because you want to get the awards. And then this didn't happen, fortunately, this cycle, because Anya Taylor-Joy has dispelled it when she can. But after she won a Golden Globe for the Queen's Gambit, she was referred to as a woman of color, and she is Latina, but she tries to always correct people and be like, no, I am white. Yeah. You do not get to claim that a woman of color, that you gave a woman of color award. Like, look at me, come on. Yeah. But there's definitely still self-congratulation where it's like, oh, she can speak Spanish. Good for us.
Yeah, it's also like, it's not to dog any of these actual shows or performances. Like I actually like all the shows that were awarded, but it's just like going back to Millie's point about the 4-year consideration campaigns. That's like a huge part of this that happens kind of not as much in the public eye, but like is a huge part of actually getting awards and like who's able to wine and dine and has connections and can throw these parties. Like there was a huge, the Golden Globes had that huge controversy because basically Emily in Paris, like, paid to get nominated by throwing a bunch of fancy parties for
they
Golden
flew
Globes.
Them to Paris. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They flew them to Paris.
Yeah. So that is when you're like watching these award shows or hearing about it, like that's a whole other element of it. That's like under the surface that's been going on for months. Like who can afford to put those billboards up? Who can afford to like send swag to voters with a cute box and all of this shit, like all of that happens.
Yeah.
And it's just like the studios taking a chance to even get a show made is already like taking so many chances. And they're like, look, we're going to make your little trans gay ballroom fucking show, but we're not going to give you any money to promote. And then when you think about things that actually have cultural impact, actually are changing society, because TV does change society. It does open up. It does like transform things, you know, like clearly, you know, and like, that's why I love it. And that's why so many people want to work in it. And that's why it's so inspiring. And like, I feel like, you know, fucking Olivia Colman, and I loved The Crown. It was fun. But like, are you telling me Pose, like MJ and Pose, and like that exactly harms her for her next project? And then at the same time, it's like Pose probably opened up and transformed so many people's point of view on trans people and the AIDS crisis and personified it in a way that like people just did not have access to and like had no context or understanding about what it was like to be a trans woman in the 80s.
But when when white actors do that for movies, like they are rewarded for it, which is definitely a difference. Like it used to be a trope where it's like the more weight you lose if you pretend to be a gender you're not, if you pretend to be gay. Yeah. Like white people are always rewarded for that. And then here you have people of color who have actually lived the experience getting nominated. And like for you guys to have what it like to have, if you are nominated, like Millie, were you to be nominated for an Emmy, that would open up paths for you, but certainly not to the degree that winning would open up a path. Yeah. Do you think the fact that there are so many nominees and presenters of color, especially this year, maybe because it was a pared down ceremony, it felt even more striking that they didn't win because there were so many nominees of color. There were so many presenters of color. The host was Black, but there were very few winners. Did that make the performative aspect of it stand out this year?
I think yes. As someone who, again, like I watched the whole thing, it really underscored that it's like all a sheen that they're putting over everything. And I think there was a moment that the Emmys cut away from where Conan O'Brien was standing up and saluting the CEO of television in a very funny and fake way. And like, even though obviously that's Conan O'Brien, he's a white man, it felt, I wanted to like stick it to the CEO of television in that moment, because it did feel like it's like, here's this lame guy. He's going to come out here. He's going to make some speech about how good we're all doing. But then actually none of you guys voted for any of these people of color to get awards. To Amanda's point, you know, if that role in Pose was played by a white man pretending to be a trans woman, he'd have two Emmys.
Absolutely.
Like he would have an Emmy for every year that he did it.
How many awards did Transparent win? Versus how many awards Pose won? You know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like, I mean, Millie, you sent this thread that put it so perfectly this morning, where, and you said this at the beginning, it's like, it's just down to like what the white people who are judging relate to. So they see Jeffrey Tambor, and if you're like a straight cis white man, you're thinking about, oh, wow. Well, like what a process.
It must be so crazy for him to pretend to be a trans woman. That must have taken so much
So incomprehensible.
Yeah. But when exactly. But when you're a queer person, you're like, and you see Pose, you're like, this is like my life and all this stuff, whatever. And I think it is just emblematic of like so many organizations that are doing it now, where it's like puppetry of like, it's not whitewashing, but it's puppetry of like, look at all these beautiful puppets we have. But actually the people pulling the strings all along are still white, and the people rewarded are still white. And it makes me a little depressed. Like you were saying, like it was so diverse and so cool, like the presenters and the nominees, but the awards and like, I'm really enjoying that show Reservation Dogs on FX. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, about Native American teens on in a reservation in Oklahoma. And they all came and presented an award and talked about indigenous rights, and they had their own little thing. And really the performances, like the last, I mean, this is an example of the power of television. The last episode talks about suicide and like shows like, I mean, it doesn't show graphically, like with a lot of respect. And then I didn't know that like suicide rates among Native American teens are the highest in this country. And like it highlighted these issues, and they gave amazing performances. And basically the whole season is like dealing with this one teenager's suicide, you know, from a year later, and how it all affects them and like how they navigate life. And it's so sad. But then when I read how many Native American teens in this country have committed suicide, and Native American people, and like I've read the articles and seeing the performances and stuff, and then I'm just thinking like, yo, they're going to lose to White Lotus.
Like, I know, but Tobias Menzies did a little accent. Like, he did a slightly different accent than his regular accent. So it to him. He couldn't even be bothered to show up. But
and like, no that's problem. The kind of shit that's exactly what happened. And like, that depressed me. It's like, fuck, they're giving this groundbreaking thing. It's so cool. And like, fuck. They're
gonna I think it might've been, it was Kerry Washington that read that one. And she was like, well, he's not here. So bye. All right. Anticlimactic. Maybe we can expect better next year, but I'm not sure. Only if the Millie Motorcycle Diaries gets made.
Yeah. Well, Millie Motorcycle Diaries is going to change the landscape of entertainment as we know it.
And hopefully American infrastructure.
Yeah.
Well, yes. If nothing else, McDonald's ice cream machines.
Yeah. If nothing else, McDonald's ice cream machines will get fixed.
You got to start somewhere. For our next story, we have our first set of civil lawsuits related to Texas abortion law. Last week, this Texas doctor named Dr. Alan Baird wrote in the Washington Post that he performed a now illegal abortion on September 6th on a patient who was in her first trimester, but beyond 6 weeks. He said he specifically performed this abortion and wrote about it so that he would be sued and so the law could be tested. He was like, I don't want them to win just by hoping we'll all stop. I want this to be litigated. This doctor has been delivering babies and performing abortions in Texas since 1972, even before Roe v. Wade. One of the people suing him is an Arkansas felon and a self-described disbarred and disgraced lawyer who served a decade in prison and is now in home confinement. That man's name is Oscar Stiley. He says he's not pro-life. Neither of these people are pro-life.
I love that he's self-described as disbarred and disgraced.
Yeah.
I love that.
Right.
Oscar Stiley also is my favorite character in the whole story that we're going through. There are several characters.
Exactly. Okay. He is quite a character. I had to read several times to actually register that this man is a pro-choice man.
Yeah.
He basically is just like, seems like an easy way to make 10K. Jokes on everybody else. He was like, worst case scenario, literally this is his rationale. He says, worst case scenario, I help overturn this law that is bad for women. Best case, like, worst case scenario, I get $10,000. Like, he wins either way, he said. He said to the Daily Beast, quote, Oscar, he referred to himself as Oscar, is going to be the fastest gun in the West. He's going to be there first. If there's money to be had, it's going to go in Oscar's pocket. He is representing himself. His 3-page like brief was absolutely insane.
I didn't know he was representing himself.
They both are.
I will also say this, Amanda. In Mexico, you ain't getting fined $10,000. They just decriminalized abortion.
I know.
And you ain't getting fined $10,000 for getting an abortion in Mexico.
But American exceptionalism.
Yeah. American exceptionalism ain't here anymore.
Now you're going to try to get an abortion. This fucking guy stuck in his house named Oscar.
Yeah, in Arkansas. A man in Arkansas who was the fastest gun in the West. Yeah. Boy,
well,
shut
up. That's the gratifying thing. He's on house arrest. He's
living under house arrest right now.
Doesn't pay taxes.
Yeah, that's what I imagine. Like a lot of internet commenters, you know, it's just like people.
There's also this guy named Felipe Gomez. He is also a lawyer. He is from Illinois. He is suing. He's been less of a character about it, but he is also just wants to be a do-gooder. And he's asked a court in San Antonio to declare the new law unconstitutional. Both suits were filed in San Antonio, and Texas Right to Life leaders are furious about this. Like, this could not be a worse set of test cases for them. Two pro-choice men who just want to make this law look stupid. I mean, Texas Right to Life referred to these as self-serving legal stunts, which I don't know what they think the law is.
Yeah.
But
the law is based on self-serving legal stunts. That's how it's enforced. Yes, by dumb ass random people suing for whatever reason they want. So yeah, that's how it's playing out.
Yeah. Well, like two things. Like one, I bet you they wanted the first cases to be like a woman who got an abortion and her like husband or partner didn't agree. And they're like so torn and like, how can you kill my baby? Blah, blah, blah. You know?
Yeah.
And then it's like these two assholes, which is like, good. Fuck you. You don't play games. You play stupid games. You get stupid prizes. Mm-hmm. But one and two, I'm learning a lot from the half episode of You're Wrong About that I've heard about the McDonald's coffee case. Mm-hmm. Is like, yeah, like this country, instead of regulating or making narrow restrictions on shit and protecting people, they make it so that we're litigious and we go into lawsuits so then they can make laws and adjust that way. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of, and like, that's kind of what the Supreme Court wanted or said. It was like, we don't know yet. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, yeah, people do dumb lawsuits, but like, it's the structure of this country to have it like that, which is dumb.
How is Oscar going to go to the Supreme Court if he's in home confinement is my question.
Well,
defending himself before the Supreme Court.
I love that he's defending himself, but still describes himself as disgraced.
Okay.
Right. They're the plaintiffs. So I guess they're just representing themselves.
Okay. But what if I write this story and I star as Oscar? I do like, I pretend to be a white man. Because I'm assuming he's white. And then I represent myself. Will I get an Oscar? for this role.
You should. I mean, I think that hits all the all
or
of the
I get institutionalized.
But then the white person who played you being institutialized, yeah, they would definitely get an Oscar for the blackface for all of it.
You, yeah. But you know what? I will say this. You know how I know everything is bullshit? Is because the Wendy Williams biopic on Lifetime was used the same format, but was way more tasteful and nuanced than I, Tanya, ever could hope to be. And that we're not giving it its flowers. And I just, and I'm so serious. I am not joking.
I need to watch that. I haven't watched it yet. And I
Tanya was disgusting.
I did not enjoy watching it.
No, because she's making jokes about, and like the Wendy Williams thing, I walked away having compassion, deep compassion for every character, for her husband, even though, you know, you kind of understand. And for I, Tanya, you're just like, why are you making jokes about getting smacked in the face? And it didn't even cover like the most fucked up anyway.
I mean, now I got something to watch tonight.
White supremacy is tearing this country apart.
And scene. For our final topic is this just completely devastating situation at the border. So amid the pandemic and economic crises ravaging Latin and Central America, plus cascading natural disasters and poverty and political turmoil in Haiti, this has resulted in more than 10,000 migrants crowded near the Del Rio International Bridge in Texas. So while they're waiting to be processed, they're sleeping outside in the dirt. They're surrounded by just growing piles of garbage and debris. There's no sanitation. There's very little access to food and water. It's a humanitarian crisis. Obviously, we've seen the images. And quite frankly and sadly, this is not the first time we have seen these kinds of images at our border, even though we have a new president. So the White House says it wants more information specifically about these videos and pictures that I wrote, I guess it was a copy, it appears to show, but they do show horses, mounted U.S. Border Patrol agents mounted on horses approaching the migrants really aggressively with ropes and whips and really a lot of violence. And there's an Al Jazeera video with a Border Patrol agent. He can be heard saying, "You use your women. This is why your country's shit, because you use your women for this." So Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, he's responding to this. Yesterday, he said he was horrified by the images and that there is an investigation ongoing. Presumably, he means what happened there was not supposed to happen, although I haven't heard those precise words. He did say that mounted agents are part of the policy and should be there. Jen Psaki is also doing damage control this morning. Here she is on CBS this morning.
He also felt they were horrific and horrible. I don't know anyone who could watch that video and not have that emotion. Last night, our Secretary of Homeland Security put out a statement conveying there'd be an investigation, that he's going to send additional personnel. And I think it's important for people to know this is not who we are. That's not who the Biden-Harris administration is. And we're going to absolutely pursue that investigation and get to the bottom of what happened here.
Mayorkas says they're working to process migrants quickly and that his agency is facilitating 1 to 3 deportation flights back to Haiti and other locations every day. So I presume that's processing them in order to send them back. It's getting them out of that really unsafe situation, but potentially sending them to another one. He also noted that the Trump-era public health order, Title 42, which basically allows us to remove migrants arriving at the border without even allowing them to apply for asylum, that that's still in effect. The Trump administration put that rule into effect during the pandemic. The Biden administration has carved out some exceptions for this, but they're also in court fighting for their ability to continue to do this. Remove does not seem like the right verb for human beings, but they are still fighting for their ability to do this. They're mainly keeping like unaccompanied minors and small children with parents. They're able to stay. If you are a single adult, you're screwed. If you're in a family with older children, you're screwed. You're getting sent back. Only refugees from Haiti who arrived in the U.S. before July 29th are eligible for temporary protected status. This, I believe, was expanded for Haitians after some of the recent natural disasters. Many reports have noted that a large number of migrants in that area, they actually originally fled to Latin or Central America after the 2010 earthquake or since. And factors such as COVID, economic hardship have driven them towards the U.S. border. So the people that are going to be deported are probably going to be deported back to a place they might have not called home for a while. Democrats are obviously calling on the Biden administration to pause these deportations. The migrant situation poses a humanitarian crisis and obviously a huge political problem for the Biden administration. And it's just like, it's not a good look for us in the world to be asking other countries to respect human rights and then to have these images emerge from our border. The world's like obviously a trash fire. And I think the hardest thing, one of the things about looking at these images is that, you know, the Biden administration comes out and they say, we'll address this. You're not going to see this in the next 24 to 72 hours. We will clean up this symptom, but it always returns. And we have not had comprehensive immigration reform in 25 years.
It just like makes me so sad because like for all the things that this country intervenes and stuff, like Haiti has always just been a terrible fucking use of like it's so close to us too. It's not like it's the other side of the world, you know, and it's just we accept asylum from other countries that like have agendas that serve us, but with Haiti, like it's just like, and I'm sure if they could stay in their own countries they would, but it's just, and it's because of shit that the US has done directly. And even like there are studies or articles now about saying like, you know, because of what France did after the revolution and how they charged taxes and stuff like, and how much money actually France owes Haiti, you know, and it is like colonialism and exploitation and stuff. And like, I mean, this is a big, you know, I've talked with Elise about this, like, and this is a big, I mean, you know, growing up in Miami, a big divide between like, non-Cuban immigrants and, you know, and Cubans who were able for a long time because Cuba was the communist country, you know, or it is a communist country, quote unquote. They were able to like emigrate here, like with no, or, you know, I mean, not that it's no problem. It's like tough.
There was like, a policy called wet foot, dry foot that was in place for a long time that basically said, if you were a Cuban person escaping communism, you could, if you made it onto US soil, then you could enjoy sort of like an easier path to immigration. That is no longer in effect, but it was the way that like a lot of Cuban immigrants were able to come here. And I think, you know, it was a way that a lot of them were able to maybe like fast track their route into the like, you know, being professional, being like in the professional class and stuff, because there are a lot of Cuban senators and doctors and all of this stuff. And like, there's a lot you can do when you're not being harassed by immigration every day. You're not trying to work through a system that is designed to keep you out. When you're working with one that's actually designed to help you get in, you can become a doctor again or a lawyer or whatever.
And like when you have, you know, you're not working these under the table, like exploitive jobs. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, so it's that faster path of citizenship. And it was also seeing like growing up and seeing that like, you know, boats and boats of Haitians would get sent back immediately, you know, without any fucking like, just because it's not a communist, whatever, it's not a communist country. Mm-hmm. And like the people were like, arguably to many people, the conditions in Haiti are worse than Cuba, you know what I mean? But like, so that is like the,
at least, you know, comparable. Like if we're going to say like that people in Cuba are under such bad conditions that they should come here, which I don't think that the conditions in Cuba are great. You can't look to Haiti and say no, but they don't have time. Again, that policy is not in place now, but there have been times, like you were saying, where Cuban Haitians aren't. And also, I mean, there are a lot of Afro-Cubans, but especially in the first wave of Cuban immigrants, a lot of white Cubans were coming, whereas Haiti is obviously getting black people who are coming. So there's that is also a factor, 100%.
Yeah. I just wish people would think of it more like, because, you know, whenever we have fights over abortion rights, we hear more about like arguments from the other side. And I guess they say a lot like, why would you kill a baby that could cure cancer? It's like, well, why don't you think that when you see the babies that are getting whipped by our border patrol trying to come from Haiti, like how do you know that baby's not going to grow up and cure cancer in this country? It's like,
right,
If we're going to assume that every brand new life has equal amount of value and potential, then let the Haitian babies in too. But no.
And just to, you know, piggyback off something you were saying earlier, Amanda, every time I leave this country, it really, like, America and exceptionalism is the thing that people believe in. Like, our view of immigration is so America focused that, like, every time I go to Latin America, I'm reminded that, like, no, actually, like, there's a lot of Venezuelans in Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Haitians all over South mm-hmm. America and in Mexico. There's parts of Mexico where you can get really great Haitian food because there's so many Haitian immigrants there. And, like, that kind of thing is not kind of ingrained. So it's something, like, just to reference that you were saying, yeah, like, they're going to deport them back to Haiti. But these people haven't lived in Haiti for like 10 or 15 years. And when I was in Colombia, I watched the local news, which I'm convinced the local news everywhere fucking sucks. But like, they had this really strong anti-immigrant sentiment in Colombia about Venezuelans and Haitians. And like, look at them. They all have crime, or like, they're staying in tents or this and that. And then I was like really disgusted by it. And I'm like, this is like Fox News level, like, propaganda in local news. But then, you know, they were at least nuanced enough to say, because I'm watching it in Spanish, but like, they were nuanced enough to say that, like, some people are taking advantage of these immigrants, like, being here and committing crimes and saying that they're Venezuelan or saying that they're Haitian and stuff. So like, that was really interesting to me.
Always.
And like, it's also interesting that, like, if a Colombian comes here, like, people don't care if you're like from Colombia or Venezuela, like, you're all viewed the same. So that was interesting. And another thing too, I think that the trouble, or like the compassion I have with Haitians, is like with other inter Latin American migration, there is, you know, like if somebody from Venezuela, obviously, like, Venezuelans, I think the richest ones would, you know, migrate to the US, but like, there are many people, it's like, yeah, they would go to Dominican Republic or to Colombia or something where they already speak Spanish and it's like an easier integration for them. But like, Haiti is like, they speak Creole. You know what I mean? They don't speak Spanish. You know, a lot of them are bilingual, multilingual, but like, that's also a language barrier too, you know, of like, wherever they go, there's not really many countries that speak Haitian Creole, you know, it's like, so that's like a barrier and a thing that I think about. And
there's nowhere you can go to be understood. I feel like you are entitled to live in this country.
Exactly.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's just tough. And like you're saying, if you're a single adult, you're screwed. But a lot of times, like, families will send one person out to migrate.
Yeah, that's a
so
great
they
point.
Can
yeah.
send money to, the, you know, so it just fucking sucks. This whole thing sucks. And the images are terrible.
Like, yeah, and it is, like, not to be callous about it, but it is a political problem, because who's going to benefit from this? Republicans. The polling says people just do trust Republicans better on immigration, even though that's incorrect. It's these images. And I think the administration knows this. Every time this happens, they're like, we'll get it sorted out between 24 to 96 hours. It's just what we inherited from the Trump administration was so bad. It's like, y'all, it's been 9 months. And every time this happens, we get very angry. And Republicans get a lot of points. So I know there's a lot of priorities, but like, we're not going to convince Joe Manchin. Let's have some meetings with some other people about some other things.
It's been really... One of the things I've been thinking a lot about is just like the cruelty that's built into the system. Like, I don't think that Joe Biden is like as hatefully xenophobic as Donald Trump. Certainly not. I don't think that he's like hateful in that way, really. But the system is built to allow for such cruelty and mistreatment that unless you are actively engaged in a massive overhaul of that system, these things are going to keep happening. Like, and Joe Biden can separate the White House and Joe Biden can separate themselves from it as much as they can, or say like, it's, you know, it's out of my hands because it's actually this person's fault or whatever. And it's like, but what we're saying is we need a complete overhaul of this system and how we are treating people and what our values are that are being put into place out here, because it needs more attention than just when 12,000 people show up at the border, the president gets on TV.
Mm-hmm. And like, just to everything that you just said is like everything, right? Like we're talking, I mean, it's all connected. It's just like, if you're not overhauling these oppressive systems, like, how are you going to expect the Emmys to change? How are you going to expect anything to change if you're going to not do some drastic reforms. And I think that's like, that is like the argument of our time, right? Is like, let's do things slow. Let's keep things the same, or let's make drastic changes and overhaul these systems that are inherently oppressive. And like, that is the argument of our time.
Yeah, exactly. On that note, that is our show. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Elise Morales.
And I'm Elise Morales.
And this is the Betches Up Podcast. Bye.
The Betches Sup podcast is produced by Amanda Duberman, Jorge Morales Pico, and Sean Kilby. Editing by Jorge Morales Pico. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Be sure to follow at Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails to suppod@betches.com. Betches.